Welcome, everybody, to the Deuce Rethread. My name is Mike. I'm usually on here with Jason Bailey, and we do an initial reaction show that posts every Sunday right after you've seen the new episode of The Deuce on HBO. But today, instead of initial reaction, we are going to do a little bit more of a deep dive. We're going to get into some of the issues around The Deuce and specifically around sex workers, which are like half the name characters in the show or something. So it seems appropriate to start to talk a little bit more about the politics, the representation, and just kind of trying to understand a little bit more about the realities that David Simon and George Pelicanos are drawing on. Pelicanos. See, Jinx, I fucked his name up already. Already. This podcast. And I can't say Pelicanos right. Today, I am joined by Jinx Lierre. Did I say that right?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's like, Lierre. I get leery sometimes. The very first time I was ever introduced on anything, it was leery. But yeah, no, Jinx Lierre is correct.
We know Jinx from Podcast Winterfell. We are a part of the DVR Podcasting Network, and another one of the podcasts on DVR is Podcast Winterfell, which covers Game of Thrones. So we do a fan call-in show every week, and this season, right, was your first call-in? Am I right about
that?
I feel like
it was my very first call-in, and I was terrified, but it was awesome.
So Jinx started calling in for the Game of Thrones fan call-in and throwing out all of her points. And at the end of your call-ins, when Tim would ask you for your social media, you would say, I have a Twitter, but it's kind of not safe, or it's not kind of, it's not safe for work. And you didn't say it like,
I feel like I have to give that disclaimer.
You're just putting it out there, you know, right? And then, so I don't know. I would hear that in the podcast, and it was just kind of in one ear and out the other. You'd be like, oh, all right, well, I don't know, whatever. That can mean a million things, right? And then one day, Axel emails me some of your Twitter and was like, she's not joking. This is definitely not safe for work. And so... So this is how, like, you know, we found the Jinx Lierre public persona that other than, like, calling in to talk about Game of Thrones. So give me your bio. You're going to describe yourself much better than I am. So fill us in on this move to the Deuce podcast.
I had not heard of that particular communication from on high. Axel being like, she's really not messing around. Has a lot of opinions and some nudity.
You're so good with the Winterfell, though. Like, it's one of those things where you would finish talking, and the last thing I was thinking about was, like, I'm thinking about all the stuff you said about Game of Thrones, and I'm going over all these things. And by the time I had worked my way through all of that, I had forgotten about the Twitter thing. So, you know, Axel listens enough that at one point he was like, wait, what does that mean? So
that's what that means, is that sometimes I'm naked on the internet. So my name is Jinx Lierre, and definitely not my birth name, but it is what you have to call me. I am naked on the internet sometimes, and some things that I am would be a fan of Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones. I identify as queer. I have a lot of tattoos. I am a third generation witch. And the thing that is actually relevant to what we're talking about today is that I am a sex worker. And I've been in the industry since about 2014, which is practically nothing in the grand scheme of things. But in porn terms, I think I'm rapidly aging out of barely legal into MILF territory. Because there's no in between.
It's a short window. It's a very short window.
I might have been a co-ed for a minute there. And relevant to that, I do want to make it clear that, like, I am not a PhD. I'm not an expert in this field in any kind of academic way. I do have a BA in, like, history and gender and sexuality studies in English, which is, you know, cool or whatever, helps me think about some of these things. And it definitely informs my perspective, as you'll see as when we're talking about the historicity of the show. But the thing that actually qualifies me to be speaking about this right now is that I have been a sex worker for years and would like to continue doing that, you know, for many years to come, ideally. And I am privileged in a lot of ways. I think that that's really important to name. I am a white cisgender woman. I have citizenship. I have no existing criminal record. I'm working independently and indoors. And in contrast, a lot of, not necessarily the characters in the show, but the people who are in our communities who are not only most vulnerable, but disproportionately targeted by the police and affected by violence from both clients and the state at large would be Black and brown trans sex workers and people who are living in poverty and people who have active substance addictions and people who are veterans and all kinds of other identities that sex workers, just like everybody else, can hold. So I identify as a sex worker pretty proudly. That was a decision that I made about probably about 2 years ago to start doing sex work activism and to organize around that. I have a background in anti-sexual violence organization and doing planning and speaking and events for that. And that really just naturally flowed into what I'm passionate about now, which is representing myself as a sex worker and trying to help people better understand the industry from our own perspective, because lots of people want to speak for us. We rarely get to speak on our own terms. So I do want to say I'm not representing any opinions but my own. Definitely not the beliefs of all people who have done sex work, because that group is diverse in every conceivable way. I am not a historian. And in fact, the college that I went to's official stance on sex work is end demand, because that makes sense, because that's a reasonable goal. It's not the institutional credentials that bring me here today. It's my experience organizing with other workers and being really excited about sharing my experiences in the industry and being really frank about it from a public policy perspective, from a communications perspective, like a media perspective, and then also just like on an interpersonal level, when I meet other people, it is kind of alarming to be somebody whose face and body are out there self-identifying as one of the most stigmatized things in our society, one of the most stigmatized professions for sure. And I think the fact that things is one of the first terms that comes to mind is pretty telling. But it feels worth it to me, because then I get to do stuff like this, and you gotta have a name to have a seat at the table.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, you've already said like 6 months worth of things that we could unpack, right? I mean, we could spend forever talking already, right? And the questions of, you know, in some ways, it's more important for cisgendered white people to talk about this stuff, because in some ways, cisgendered white people are heard more. But in some ways also, you know, in many ways, cisgendered white people can't speak for the experiences of, right? So like just that by itself is, you know, deciding to kind of where you draw the line and how you kind of deal with that is something that you have to rethink, or at least have a thought of every time you speak about these things. The idea of
definitely is.
Well, and the idea of, you know, the stigma that you're talking about, and language and these things, like all just in your kind of introduction there, just the fact that you have like a lot of have really spent a lot of time thinking about this stuff and discussing this stuff, I think is relevant to what we're doing here. You know, I mean, it's interesting to talk about kind of the early porn movies and, you know, as a filmmaker and like, you know, in talking with Jason and stuff, that's what we talk about because that's what we do, you know? And so it's kind of, that's the first thing that comes out as being interesting to us, but it's easy for us to do that without really thinking critically about the relationships between the sex workers, the relationships between sex workers and pimps. Like, it's easy for me to like be like, oh, she's looking at the lights, you know, and not think about what that what the decision is to go from sex work into porn, which is a completely different. So anyway, I'm just still sex work, right? But like, is its own decision, you know, is its own kind of like. Anyway, I don't know. This is what I'm saying, I guess, is like, I feel like I should just stop talking and like let you just kind of read your notes, because, and that's why, you know, I'm really glad that you decided to join us today, and I'm excited to hear your thoughts on a lot of this stuff. And basically what I plan to do is just kind of be like, what about this? And then learn things. So,
okay, perfect.
You mentioned that you that you were kind of bummed to find out that they were making the show at all, and I guess that that's a reflection on how representation of sex workers usually happens in these things. Talk about that a little bit. I mean, you've seen the first three episodes, right? We're recording this after episode three, yeah. season 1, episode 3.
I've seen three episodes. So like, I'm 3.5 hours into the show. How many episodes are there going to be?
There's 8 total.
8. Okay. So we're like, I guess, around halfway through the season.
Yeah. But you had all kinds of thoughts on this before episode 1 was available on HBO Go. Like, you were already deep in the weeds on this stuff. So
the instant that I saw the preview play before, I'm trying to watch Game of Thrones, because as I mentioned, I'm a very big Game of Thrones fan. And I was, you know, gathered around my TV with actually another sex worker, and we watched TV too. And in a hotel room, actually, I'm now realizing we were definitely in a hotel room because one of us had worked. Oh my God. So probably part of why I was not in the best of moods, just to see, I literally stood up and I was like, is that Maggie Gyllenhaal playing a street-based sex worker? Is that really what mine eyes are landing upon from the home box office right now? Like, are they really making this decision? Because it does make me nervous every time I see or hear of a representation of sex work. The media does not have any form of any kind of media does not have a good track record with representing sex workers. And in fact, TV Tropes, which I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with, even has an entry called Disposable Sex Worker, and kind of goes into how often we are essentially an object to be abused, to be exploited, to be murdered, oftentimes to point out the innocence of other women, civilian women, or non-sex workers, if you're not familiar with that term. I think it might be helpful if I take a second to define some of the terms that I'm going to use. Because okay. I know a lot of people aren't familiar with them. And I know that language is something that people really stumble around when discussing this. And it's very interesting to be a sex worker and hear people talking to you who aren't in the industry about like kind of what they choose to use. And there are certain people who, like, if you say that once, they're like, oh, sex worker. And then other mm-hmm. people will never stop using like courtesan or like people... There's lots of words that people use for us, and many of them are not particularly flattering or respectful. So,
like many other words that people just use, a lot of them have violent or specific histories that people just aren't conscious of, and they're not conscious of it because they don't give a shit.
I mean, exactly. I mean, what's the worst thing you can call a woman who doesn't do sex work is a sex worker, you know? Right. And I think that is one of the ways, if you control F when I'm doing research to find out more about sex workers in Game of Thrones, because I'm also super interested in that. When you like go through any of the text to find that, what's going to come up at least 3 to 4 times as many times as they're actually talking about sex workers is a woman who's not a sex worker being put down by being called one. So,
yes,
exactly.
Which is super annoying, because that's a waste of your fucking time too, by the way.
It's so hard to research, you know?
Right.
So
I realize that's not the most essential part of that story, but...
But it is also annoying. So yeah. It's really a spectrum from like totally horrifying to a minor inconvenience.
Right.
So the term sex worker itself was coined by Carol Lee, also known as the Scarlet Harlot, in 1980. And it's supposed to be a value-neutral descriptor that names the labor, aligns us with histories of labor organizing and resistance, and indicates that workers deserve rights just like in other industries. So we're seeing in the show the portrayal of union labor. And somebody even, I believe one of the cops even makes a joke about the no-go zones and like how that's working out. And I'll definitely have more to say about the relationship with the police later. But one of the cops says, oh, well, maybe all the whores got together and bought a free pass for themselves. And that idea of us actually coming together is so often mocked. But in reality, there is a history of sex worker activism, and there is a history of sex workers recognizing that we are laborers just like people in other industries. And I think that one of the things that I do think that this show did really well, and I know you're a fan of, is that conversation between Candy and Stuart, the birthday boy, about sex work and about it being real work and about the fact that annoying clients and clients who aren't demanding, everybody's going to have to pay the same. You don't get a pass or a discount for being nice because this is work.
What do you do, Stuart?
I'm in school.
What's your daddy do?
He sells cars. He's got a dealership.
And that's his job, right? Someone comes in, knows just the car he wants, doesn't dick around, doesn't need a long test drive, doesn't argue about the color or whatever. Does he give him the car for less? Does he pay less? Then the guy who comes in, takes forever, gotta drive 5 or 6 cars, talk about the radio, the white walls, everything else before he's done and ready to buy. He doesn't give the easy customer 2 cars for the price of 1, right?
One of the things I liked about that I couldn't verbalize at the time is how kind of infantilized the audience was in that scene, right? Which we deserve to be spoken to on that level and to be kind of infantilized inside in that character, because the perspective that she's speaking to is so pervasive and so fucking obvious. It shouldn't be that hard to figure out, right? It shouldn't be, you know, but that idea of like, it's not fair, like, meh, you know, it just like,
yeah.
Oh my God, that was so good. And it's so smart.
It's so realistic too, if I can just real quick, like, it's my birthday. I think Jim Gaffigan even used to have a joke about that. Oh, I have to pay for sex on my birthday. Like, yeah, dude, like if you're going to hire a sex worker, you're going to have to pay her. But I really like that. And I think that's a really good way to put it, of being like, okay, like if you're really starting off watching this show with no experience with this industry at all, which most people don't have any firsthand experience with the industry, that they acknowledge, because buying porn totally counts. And by the way, buy your porn. Don't steal your porn, because that is also labor. But a lot of people think that they've never met one of us in real life. And so you're wrong, by the way. We're definitely like your neighbors and friends and colleagues and fellow fans, but we have a lot of cultural reasons why we don't speak out. And it's because of the criminalization, it's because of the stigmatization, and it's because it's so rare for people to think about it in an objective way like that. So I really loved that Candy kind of, she wasn't even looking at the camera. She was looking in the mirror. She like rolled her eyes and she was looking mm-hmm. in the mirror, putting on lipstick and just so over it, like so checked out already. And just like, ugh, do I really have to do this for the millionth time?
Well, and she said, what really do you do? What does your dad do? Right? It doesn't matter what he answered. She was going to be able to give him a story. Right.
Exactly.
And that's part of being bored with it. Right. Like she yeah. has said this a million fucking times, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's just like every single dude in the strip club is sitting there thinking to himself, I'm not like all the other guys. And sometimes they say that out loud. And I used to be a stripper. I'm no longer a stripper because my knees can't handle it anymore. But
that's fucking work. I don't give a shit. That's work. That's
it's a lot of work. And the hours are just like killer. But I definitely.
No, I mean talking to them dudes. For 75% of the time that you're there, like
do you mean yelling at drunk
yes,
men?
Yes.
Yelling the same conversation at drunk men 40,000 times,
which is not to suggest which is not to suggest that I am capable of any of the dancing required either. I'm just saying that 75% of your job, small talking drunk dudes, the fuck out of here. That's work. That's hard work.
So,
anyway.
You're also identifying that emotional labor is the term that is most often used for that. And the fact that it's not just the sexual labor that people come to us for, also emotional labor. And we see that with Darlene and her regular who likes watching Tale of Two Cities and the other like old movies that they're watching.
Mildred Pierce, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Larry is even like, you know, you guys are just watching movies, but that's super common. I mean, I can't say I've ever sat down to watch A Tale of Two Cities with somebody for the entirety of our time together, but I also haven't ever had an interaction with a client where I left not feeling like they had wanted me to see their humanity in some way. And I think that's one of the deep ironies of sex work is that men, very often men, but not always, come to us and they want to be seen and heard and listened to and respected and desired and all of these things, admired. I could say less flattering things about certain people, but I think
and
in
not
general,
not judged
exactly, and precisely to not be judged. And yet what is it that we then have to deal with is the exact opposite of all of that. We are judged, we are stigmatized, we are dehumanized, we are depersonalized, and oftentimes
by the same person
at the exact same moment. I think one of the most disturbing things, you know, I've had some fucked up shit said to me over the course of many, many jobs. I used to be a waitress. People like to say, quick aside, people like to say, don't you think your job is degrading? First of all, rude question. Second, no, the most degrading job I've ever had was working at Applebee's. I am in control of my own schedule, my own body, my own life in so many more ways than I was when I was a like brick in the corporate pyramid. It's a really difficult line for me to walk because on one hand, I want to say, hey, look at me doing this consensually. This is real. This is real labor. This exists and I'm doing it because I want to. And on the other hand, I don't think that I should have to be held to that standard. And my experience of doing this work is really informed and affected by my privilege. And the fact that I can say I haven't been arrested and I haven't had experiences with physical violence from a client, that is something that in many, many ways is a result of me being white and cisgender and being college educated and being all kinds of other things that are deemed more valuable in society and are literally more valuable in the industry. And that comes to the expense of devaluing other workers. Particularly, it's about how close can you be to a white supremacist, cisgender, heterosexual, slim, able-bodied version of perfection. That's who can charge the most amount of money. We're all still whores. But there's going to be a very big difference in how you are treated, not only by clients, but also by the state. And so I think about that a lot when I'm thinking about how I talk about work, because I don't want to make it seem like I am skipping happy-go-lucky through the field and saying, like, this is the best job that every single person who can should do. It's really about, hey, this is what was working for me with the choices that I am being afforded at this time. And I think that that is something that really comes through with the characters in the show, because one of the first things that we see is, I believe, Vinny being like, you know, I'm just trying to feed my fucking family. And that's what everybody in the entire world, really, but the show is trying to do. And I don't think that it is fair. It is, in fact, one of many, many double standards that we can discuss, that sex workers are held to the expectation that we have to say that we are doing this, you know, happily. The myth of
everybody hates their fucking job someday, like, isn't
exactly
that, shouldn't that be okay too?
I'm constantly straddling this line where I don't want to be like, yeah, it's the best, but I also don't want to be like, but also, like, I feel like I can't say anything either way about it in like without pissing somebody off, and that's about my own job. So I think it's pretty clear how many people have opinions on that. So back to the terminology that I was talking about before I so rudely interrupted myself. I do think that it covers the term sex work. It covers a really wide variety of work. So that does include porn. It does include transactional sex, pro kink, erotic modeling, stripping, sensual massage, camming, pretty much like human sexuality. The list is infinite. There are a lot of things that fall under that umbrella, but the point is to have this unifying factor of, hey, here is this industry that has always been in demand, but also appears to have always been stigmatized. And by using more neutral language, I am trying to take it from somebody's defining feature to one part in a constellation of identities that every sex worker holds. So, like, I started off my personal introduction by mentioning that I'm a witch and I have Lord of the Rings tattoos and stuff like that. Like, this is one aspect of my life, but so often it becomes the defining feature because it is so stigmatizing.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay.
Go ahead.
I kind of want to ask something like even more foundational, though, which is the idea that for a lot of people, sex is, I don't know. I mean, say intimate is like a kind of vague term. And for a lot of people, sex is embarrassing, to be honest. Like, let's just be totally honest about it, right? For a lot of people, it's confusing. It seems to me like a lot of this kind of stigmatizing of sex workers specifically, but even also just people who are comfortable with sometimes even just nudity, which is I mean, that's like your, it's hard. Like, how are you going to be embarrassed about nudity, right? Like, you're born with it. I mean, just kind of, but it seems like to me a lot of times that reaction is a person who is in some way ashamed of their own desires or experiences or some in that way, and they are projecting that out. But then I think there's also, so I'm kind of curious. This is a shit question. I'm doing terrible at coming to
a question
here.
Your own question, which is that I think the pinnacle of the hypocrisy that you are talking about and like discomfort that you are talking about would be the politician who hires us, but also creates laws that are ostensibly anti-trafficking laws, whereby right. we can be arrested for trafficking ourselves if we are doing things to keep ourselves safer, like working with another person, like having somebody drive us places. Like, do God forbid you cross state lines to do mm-hmm. sex work. That's a really serious problem. So, you know, I mean, it's really, when you look at who is actually putting legislation like this forward, it is almost always the same male, overwhelmingly male politicians who are writing trap laws, targeted restrictions on abortion providers. And oftentimes female politicians, especially white female politicians, who are using what seems like the obvious get of anti-trafficking as a platform, because how could you possibly be for trafficking girls? It's always about the children. It's always about like, oh my God, well, you wouldn't right. want and, girls to be sex slaves. But
I've never met a sex worker who was like, no, we should traffic more 12-year-old children from Central America. Like, that's not a thing that I've never seen an interview with a sex worker that has supported that. And it's like the lack of nuance and distinguish in that conversation. You know, when you just say the word trafficking, right? It's that, I think, is a major problem, at least in the current conversation, too.
Absolutely. And thank you for bringing me to my next point. Nobody's going to believe that you don't have access to my notes. Because the thing about sex work being work is that sex work and sex trafficking are different. You will notice they have different words in them, but also right. that difference is consent. So if you right. can perceive that sex and rape are not the same thing, you can understand this. I believe in you. Because, you know, and even with, I think that as hard as it was to watch, it was very realistic to see the scene where Darlene appears to be sexually assaulted. And then later you see her with the same client. And she has a conversation with him and he offers her more money because he hurt her and left more marks on her than he was supposed to.
That was a little rough.
Yeah, I know. Got away from me there this time, I guess.
My wrist also hurts.
Oh, geez, Darlene, you know I'm sorry. You got me going tonight. The next was 24, okay?
So it kind of starts off with the assumption that she's not consenting to that, and then it goes back to being like, okay, well, she did consent to that, but it really complicates it, and this is a very real thing that happens.
It was weird to feel relieved by that second scene, but I did feel relieved. I have yeah. to like admit that. You know what I mean? I have to say that out loud.
I think that is really one of the scenes that linked me back to feeling like, oh man, I wish this just wasn't getting made. Because
yeah.
it makes me nervous to see our stories represented, because almost always it is about us being abused. And there are very real consequences to that, because the fact of the matter is, like I was saying, most people think they don't know workers. So what is their exposure is coming to it from seeing mass media. So,
but is there any good way to talk? I mean, is there a good way to represent something like that? I don't know if it feels like it's so complicated that I don't know if you can, even if you just made a whole show about that scene or moments like it, is it possible, do you think, from your perspective? I mean, you know, you've said you've never experienced violence from a client. So from the perspective you have available, I don't know, this is a thing that I think about all the time as a creator. Is it are there certain things that I just don't know if it's possible to represent well? And those become things that I just avoid because I don't have the balls to try, to be honest. There are certain things that I just don't do as a creator.
I mean, there's certain stories that are not to be told by anybody. I mean, I would personally argue most stories are not to be told by people who are not affected by the implications of putting that on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that ultimately my answer would be no. I'm going to keep coming back to, I would rather just not see it, because I don't trust the show. I don't trust writers. I don't trust, I know that they consulted with sex workers to create this. Annie Sprinkle is a fairly well-known sex worker mm-hmm. rights activist who, I'm not sure she's credited in the show, but I know that, definitely in all the interviews that they were doing prior to the show going live, they really wanted everybody to know that they had talked to a couple sex workers. and that was one of the first things that got thrown in my face when I took issue with it. And I was like, okay, but I am one too, and I don't know how I feel about this. Because I don't feel confident in also commentators' ability to have compassionate conversations about these narratives that acknowledge the intricacies of the reality that these women are living. I mean, primarily.
Okay, have you listened to our podcast? Have you listened to?
I have. I listened. I listened to this one that I'm on right now. Have I listened to it? Yes.
So tell me. I mean, talk to me about I don't care. Tell me that I did it wrong or whatever. I'm interested to hear how you hear these things. You said commentators, obviously not, I'm obviously not just me, but I'm interested in how you hear this stuff and how you've heard the commentary around it so far.
Well, I'm going to return that with a question. How have you heard the show described in general? What are some adjectives that come up immediately? The one that I seeing is gritty. So there's and yes. Which is to some degree, I think, going to be dropped anytime anybody who had anything to do with The Wire touches the television show. But it's gritty.
Yeah.
But that word in particular is so often used to describe portrayals of sex workers. And that in and of itself puts me on edge. So there's this first level of the show is being created and it's tackling these concepts. Then there's the level of, as a culture, we're going to be discussing the contents of this show, and we are going to be discussing the lives and the identities of the people portrayed there. And so I'm absolutely not going to call you guys out for there's nothing, believe me. Oh man, you would know. This would have, the whole interview would have started with, first of all, that time you said this was really fucked up. But I think, let's address the dead hooker in the room. Most portrayals of sex workers are not only derogatory, but violent. And it matters because a sex worker has been murdered since the show began. And it matters because so many sex workers have come and gone out of this world having experienced violence, in part because it is seen as an inevitability of our industry. And the woman who was murdered on September 18th, her name was Cece Thibert, and she was a 28-year-old in Montreal, and she was a trans woman. She was a sex worker, and she was white. But it's worth noting that Black and brown trans sex workers are much more likely to experience violence, and that at least 22 trans people have been murdered in 2017 alone. So not all of those people were sex workers, but some of them were. And ultimately, this is an epidemic, and stigma is literally killing people.
An inevitability of our, I mean, that's like, that, there's not a lot of hope in that description.
I mean, there's not, but like, tell me a joke about a hooker that isn't about her being dead.
Ugh.
Like, ugh. Think about, like, yeah. I could name multiple movies offhand that center around the death of a sex worker, and their comedy, right. You know, like, and that's to say nothing of stuff that intends to portray the work as gritty. So I feel like there is like the, that word and violence and sex work have all become so linked that when I hear that something is going to be on the screen, I assume it is going to be of that ilk, because rarely am I wrong.
Well, and we've
like,
seen,
that's kind of what I want to say. It's like, prove me wrong.
Yeah, we've had 3 episodes so far, and in one of them, Ashley gets cut, and in another one, Darlene gets beat up.
Yep.
In 3 episodes.
And I mean, that is really... I think one of the most helpful things for thinking about this that I use is something that was created by the Mentors in Violence Prevention at Northeastern University, and it's the Pyramid of Interpersonal Violence. So it starts at the bottom, the foundation being attitudes and beliefs. And so that is where we are when we're talking about dead hooker jokes, and that is where we are when we are hearing characters on the show call, like Rudy calls the sex workers on the street human garbage. And I mean, it's just also referring to people who are using drugs in the street. Not like that's any better, but you know, those kinds of things being said about us all the time devalues us and devalues the work and devalues our lives. And so you move up in that to like, you know, haha, like that's so funny. The next level is verbal expression, like to us, and then physical expression, and then sexual assault, and then murder. And those, that concept is not specific at all to sex work. This is a concept that is used in lots of bystander intervention trainings, and or like a model that is used in a lot of bystander intervention trainings, and that like abuse networks use to kind of understand, hey, when you make a joke about rape, it makes people feel like rape is okay. And it's not like,
and
oh,
it's just
you
a
made
thing.
One joke,
it's inevitable.
And then you go out and you rape somebody. That's, nobody is saying there's like an exact causal relationship. But we live in a culture whereby violence towards sex workers is normalized. And the inevitability really comes in when you think about, like, how do we talk about when sex workers encounter violence? And that is really, like, you know, where my fear of the commentary comes in. Because it's one thing to see something represented on a show and be like, you know what, that's like fairly realistic. And it's another to hear somebody in 2017, especially if it's somebody that I'm friendly with, and especially, I mean, not that many people in my life don't know that I'm a sex worker, but, you know, people still say ridiculous things all the time. Mm-hmm. To hear somebody who's watching the show be like, well, you know, that's just what happens. Or like when we see headlines that are about like prostitute found dead, not even naming the person, not generally doing anything other than speculating about like whether or not it was over money or drugs or, mm-hmm. and it's generally assumed to have been by a client. So, I mean, all you really need to think about with respect to that is like, how often have you heard like junkie whore or like talking or like hearing people talk about like a slippery slope from like, oh, well, if you start doing, you know, X drug, you know where you're going to end up or where your daughter is going to end up is like in some back alley. And then
sucking dick for XYZ.
Yep. Right. Yep. And right. It's really just seen as not a big deal. And that has a demonstrable impact on our lives because people know that it's okay to mistreat us.
So does the filled out representation of at least Candy, let's say, I think anyone could say like you could give her even more, right? Like, but there is, we see her mom, we see her son, we see, you know, the pimps trying to kind of push up on her and they're saying like, no, I own my own, like da da da. Does that kind of more filled out representation, does that balance in any way? It's a different subject. I mean,
there are definite things about seeing Candy's narrative that resonated with me. So like watching her be very concerned about sexual health, a lot of people stigmatize sex workers and sexual health and consider us to be like diseased or like, you know, vectors of infection. But in reality, and this is demonstrable, sex workers tend to have better sexual health practices and we sure as hell tend to get tested more. So to see mm-hmm. Candy engaging with safer sex practices and then to receive that call that she gets about gonorrhea and to see her like coping with that, like, that is very real. To see her mom be incredibly passive aggressive on a regular basis about like, oh, I guess some of us have to make a living on our backs, or like, oh, well, maybe your son will grow up to do something important, like be a doctor or a lawyer. That resonates with me. To see her just generally be exhausted at the end of the night and doing the administrative work that it takes to maintain this. You know, a lot of people think of this even street-based work, which is supposedly, you know, the most desperate, the least skilled, even street-based work is like not requiring any amount of actual business sense, when in reality, we're seeing her behind the scenes keeping up with regulars and putting away her money, mm-hmm. all of those things. I think that is cool. However, oh, also one more time. One more thing. I love how she orders a seltzer and lime at the bar that Vinny has, because it's just such a like industry thing to not actually be drinking alcohol, but you have to look like you're partying, you know, and mm-hmm. you have to, I think mm-hmm. that was something that you identified in your first episode, Rethread. Was like so much of the job is, again, to return to that concept of emotional labor, to make it seem like you're having the best time of your life, just like they are. Right. And those are all
party.
Things. Exactly. Those are all things that are interesting to see represented. Do I necessarily feel like this is like my truth on screen right now? Like, no, I'm just like, oh, like those parts are accurate. I think it's really worth pointing out that it is Candy and Abby who have the more fleshed out backstories. And they're mm-hmm. also the two most conventionally attractive white woman yep. characters on the show, and that the character Ruby is rarely actually even referred to as Ruby. She is a black woman, and she is definitely thicker than most of the rest of the characters, and she's almost universally referred to as Thunder Thighs, which is like pretty objectifying. And I am not going to sit here and expound for long periods of time about the way that race functions in this show, because I am a white woman, and there's a lot of people who could say a lot of things that are a lot smarter and more insightful than I had.
We're going to have those conversations too. So you don't have to take responsibility for everything, but
awesome.
You know, yeah.
But it is really worth pointing out that the centering of these very suburban, you know, if Abby is going to NYU and her mom's, she's apparently from Old Saybrook, Connecticut. but like, okay. Yeah. But also, Candy / Eileen, you know, her mom lives in the burbs, and there's this sense that like, she's going to break out of this life. She's going to be doing something better. And that narrative is very boring to me. I understand that nobody can do any job forever, but it's so common for us to be expected to get rescued out of the industry, whether that's by a man or ourselves recognizing the error of our ways and moving on to more respectable money making.
Right. And you're not allowed to just like be tired of your fucking job. Like, I mean, I could list you four different like things that I did for five or more years that I just got tired of doing. Right. And it wasn't like some moral crusade that I stopped being a dishwasher. I just like didn't want to wash dishes anymore, you know? And it seems like those kind of, like that kind of decision making is never really granted to sex workers.
No.
We should talk a little bit too about, because you're talking about Candy, and we should talk a little bit too about your previewing Twitter conversations you had with Maggie Gyllenhaal, who actually seems to be interested, kind of.
She is. I do want to say one more thing on the subject of like what is what I see as, and given I haven't seen the second half of the season, but what I see as really centering the narratives of the two most sort of normal, quote unquote, like normal, sweet, like white girls on the show, is that when we talk about the historical background of this time period and of sex workers in this time period, it is not uncommon to do what the show is doing, which is erasing black and brown trans women sex workers who were foundational not only to the sex worker rights movement, but were actually the real radicals who led the Stonewall Uprising. So the Stonewall Inn was an incredibly notorious bar in New York City that in 1969 was the site of an uprising led by women like Sylvia Rivera, like Marsha P. Johnson, like Miss Major Griffin Gracie, who is, by the way, still around, still kicking ass, still fucking here, still doing incredible civil rights work. Look her up. Contribute to her retirement fund.
Like without
literally
a day off.
Forever.
Since,
forever.
Right. Without
since
a day off.
Day.
Yeah.
Because what is lost in the whitewashing and the retelling, the respectable retelling of the beginning of this so-called gay rights movement, is that this bar was notorious not just because cisgender gay men were there, but rather because this is where drag queens, trans women, sex workers, gender nonconforming people, this is where people were gathering. And particularly, this is where the police were harassing people. And we see that a little bit in the show. The bar that Vinny ends up with, didn't get busted by the cops, but it's clear that there's a lot of reasons why having a gay bar at that time period was incredibly problematic. So one of the biggest concerns that the cops had with this particular bar was that there were sex workers there, and particularly that there were trans women sex workers there. And those women were who, you know, threw the first bricks. Those women are the people who have been organizing for our liberation for generations now. And it is because of racism, because of transphobia, because of respectability politics, that their contributions have been eclipsed or entirely obscured. And it's important to recognize that in doing that, you're continuing to make it seem like sex workers are only ever victims. That is a pivotal moment in us organizing for our rights and to be free. And I say us, I mean sex workers, but there's a lot of other things that were happening there and a lot of other identities that were very, very relevant that are now being lost in retellings. And like the Stonewall movie that came out not that long ago was about a bunch of white gay dudes. So right. Like, where are the sex workers in that? Where is the monument to us outside that building? There's not. There's like two gay dudes and two lesbians. So it's not uncommon for us to get unwritten out of, or written out of our actual accomplishments, to have other people be credited for them, to have them be whitewashed and mainstream such that they appear more appropriate. But honestly, sex workers have been on the front lines of radical politics for generations. And we are now, too, because we really have no other choice. Our lives depend on it.
Well, and that's part of
why I get so fired up about this. And that is why it worries me when I see Maggie Gyllenhaal on HBO representing a street-based worker in 1971, because that was in 1969. That was about a 15-minute subway ride away from what we're seeing, and 2 years, and that is not being touched at all. The only trans woman I have seen in the show is a woman who is present at the opening of the bar in episode 3, and the only way that you know that she is a trans woman is that the captions take, they actually bother to go in parentheses, deep voice, like, hey, or something. Like, it's identified that so it's a trans woman of color, and it makes it clear through that is kind of that is what that character is supposed to represent. But in reality, like, you know, I recognize not every show is a documentary. Like, I get that. So I'm sure there's going to be people who are listening to this who are like, well, why does this even matter? And it's because we are not always victims. And yet we are portrayed as such. We were organizing at this time. We were getting together. Sex workers were, you know, communicating with each other like we always have, for our safety, for our well-being. You hear when the paddy wagon pulls up, you hear one of the girls go, "Ho, patrol!" And like they all scatter, because that depiction of the transfer of knowledge between workers and the way that people organize in space is so accurate. But it's been kind of whittled down to only the most central of the identities that were not even necessarily present. They're just the ones that we really want to represent because this is what we think people are going to respond to.
Yeah. Well, and I don't, you know, I always wonder how much of that has to do with like bullshit marketing concepts and all these other things too, that are just like so fucking banal and like awful that you just don't even want to talk about them. But I think another thing that like the whitewashing process does, you know, you look at the Martin Luther King statue and most of what he said, like there's nothing about what he said about Vietnam. Most of what he said about poor people has all been taken out, you know, and part of that process, part of the whitewashing of Stonewall also removes the fact that the in a lot of ways, some of the leaders of that movement were, even within that threatened community, the most threatened individuals. And, you know, what you say about feeling like we are organizing because we don't have a choice, because nobody else is doing it for us, right? Because we are individually and particularly threatened, I think is something that should be a part of the conversation.
Thank you for listening to The Deuce on the DVR Podcast Network. You can check us out at dvrpodcast.com or on Twitter at @DVRPodcast. You can email Mike and Jason at thedeucedvr@gmail.com or follow them on Twitter at @thedeucedvr.